From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Oh, just be like, relax on the couch. Let me just play a record for you. You can just chill out. So we do a lot of taking care of each other.
Oh, you're so lucky.
It's booze self-care.
That's brother and sister duo Andre and Tanaya Darlington. We've been talking about how music and cocktails make great friends. With Coachella wrapping up this weekend, the Darlingtons are here to help you keep the party going with their latest book. It's called Booze and Vinyl. It features 70 albums with cocktail pairings. I love that you're siblings.
We love it too.
It's been an unlikely pairing for us.
Although we started with a family newspaper, so it just feels like this was all meant to be.
What era of music did you grow up with?
19th century. Our father was a classical musician, so we grew up with a lot of classical music, but then 70s, 80s, and 90s, I would say.
Yeah, Simon and Garfunkel was big in our house. John Denver, Ravi Shankar, and
the Chieftains.
Brahms.
Sounds like my house.
It doesn't.
So how does one best prepare for a boozy listening party? Is it a surprise for people, or does it become a focus of interaction?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, we think of records as being so social because we grew up with our dad hosting listening parties. And our favorite part of writing this book really was coming up with the various themes. So, we put on a record like Carole King, Tapestry, and then ask each other, like, okay, what do you want to be drinking? Who do you want to have over? And immediately we were like, clothing swap. I want something smoky. So we sort of worked backwards on a lot of these albums. And I guess that's what we hope that people will do, is whatever their mood. You know, the book is in four chapters, each depending on a mood. And so that they'll pick a mood and just sort of explore from there.
Okay, so I understand that you have a record player with you.
Ah, oh, we do. We never travel without a traveling bar and a suitcase record player.
See, I love that. So why don't you put on a little snippet of something for us, and then you can serve us a cocktail.
Done.
Perfect.
So we have a little blue suitcase Crosley player. Andre's dropping the needle, and we think you'll know exactly what this is.
Man, I'm not sure I'm ready for a drink.
A temple
with this
rub?
One.
Well, we were going to serve you either an East India cocktail, which is side A, or side B, margarita. All of the LPs in the book have a side A and side B cocktail.
Why a margarita?
Lovely Rita Mittermaid. Does it make you want a margarita?
There we go.
For some of the albums we chose, you know, cocktails that went with the name of some of the drinks, we did a St. Cecilia punch for the Simon and Garfunkel's St. Cecilia. But some of them we did cocktails that were either something that the artists themselves actually drank, or in the case of Blondie, we were able to find the cocktail menu for Max's Kansas City, where they all hung out, and there was a Blondie cocktail on the menu, mm-hmm. which turns out to have been what we know as a golden Cadillac. But we had fun pairing the cocktails, whether they were actually historically accurate or just a bit of fun. The way
I'm amazed that Max's Kansas City had a cocktail menu.
It's grim. The menu is very humorous and clearly designed as just an addendum to drugs.
And what is a golden Cadillac?
Well, bring back your tall bottle of Galliano, break out some half and half, and I think what's the last thing in there, Andre? Is there a little powdered sugar or something like that?
A little powdered sugar, yeah.
It's a plush, creamy drink. And our theme for Blondie's Parallel Lines is actually a punk rock tea party, so we love to serve this drink, shake it up and pour it into a teacup. Because Blondie once famously hosted a women in rock tea party in a London hotel. And so that just made us so happy. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun to recreate, you know, Blondie's punk rock tea party with your friends and make a pair of delicious cocktails that matched?
Those are pretty easy, too.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the drinks in the book are just two or three ingredient drinks.
I have to ask you, are Jello shots still a thing? Do adults do them?
You're pretending like you don't know.
That's not my world.
I do think that they're coming back, alas. And there is a Jello shot in this book.
For the Ramones.
For the Ramones.
I believe we do a garage, punk rock garage party and have...
It's nice because you can pre-make them and just chill them and not have to think about shaking and stirring.
What color are they for the Ramones? They should be grape. They should be something very dark.
Or maybe you mix two things together, like lime and cherry.
We just give a master recipe, and people can use whatever type of Jello they prefer.
But we have started seeing some gourmet Jello shots appearing in various bars using things like orange Jello and Campari.
Yeah, Negroni Jello shots.
Negroni Jello
are
shots
popular
are big
right now. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't need to know about that.
We want to frown, but we can't because they're delicious.
Okay, drop something else on the turntable.
Well, we have some really fun selections for you here. Let's see what Andre's going to pull up.
Let's do.
We really got into tiki cocktails with our first book, The New Cocktail Hour, which was something we didn't expect to love so much. And so when we were writing this book, our first question was, well, who is going to be the tiki party? So this is the tiki soundtrack. Evan.
Oh, I love. An interesting and unexpected pairing.
Do you think?
Yeah. I love tiki cocktails. So what's the particular one that you would do with this?
Well, we have a special tiki Chex mix we came up with for the book because there are a few snacks.
We love the Mai Tai, which is a much maligned cocktail, but made correctly is just unbelievably good.
So we have a side A.
It's too good.
It's too good.
It's dangerously good. But we thought, you know, the Talking Heads has all these interesting Afro beats. It was way ahead of its time. It still sounds so modern. Tiki is so popular still now. And it's such a fun album to put on, you know, when it's nice outside and people can go in and out of the house and have a refreshing drink to these guys. It's and then we do a Missionary's Downfall, which is another one of our favorite tiki drinks, which is a lovely rum with a little mint and pineapple.
Yeah, ooh. Talking Heads just makes us want to garnish, so you can just garnish that up. Like, cover your coffee table in garnishes or your picnic table and just, like, throw people into drinks making and have a garnish off.
Oh, I love that. Now, what about whiskey? Whiskey is so in focus these days. What would you spin, let's say, with a fine Japanese whiskey?
Oh, that's a good question.
We actually have a little whiskey tasting that we like to do with the White Stripes. The White Stripes seem so Americana in a great way. And I think we'd still do the White Stripes even with Japanese whiskey.
Why not? Yeah, Jack White is a huge lover of vinyl, and the White Stripes were well known for loving whiskey on tour. And so we suggest put on the White Stripes and ask everyone to bring a different bottle of whiskey and have a whiskey tasting. And Andre wrote up a great segment on how to taste through whiskeys, you know, putting them all in brown bags and giving everyone notebooks so they can write down all their tasting notes. You know, which you can do for side A, and then side B, you probably just want to let people pour whatever they want.
How fun. Okay, talk to me a little bit about using eggs in cocktails and how to get over, for most people who make things at home, how to get over the fear of using eggs in cocktails.
Well, one of the things that I hear bartenders ask customers is, did you wash your eggs before you made scrambled eggs for yourself in the morning? And almost 100% of the time, the answer is no. And the bartender will say, well, I washed these eggs that we use at the bar, so they're cleaner than the eggs that you use at home. You know, in theory, the alcohol helps kill the bacteria. I don't think there's been any, you know, known evidence of anyone ever getting sick from an egg cocktail. We really love them. We really, you know, try to get people involved with them. We love the mouthfeel. We have an obsession. And I know people can do it these days with... you know, aquafaba is popular as well to do a vegan version of it.
Describe what aquafaba is.
Aquafaba is essentially bean water that you shake.
Like chickpea water.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's miraculous, actually.
It is miraculous.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of New York sours with egg whites in them, which is one of our favorite drinks. And that's, you know, you're basically combining whiskey and egg, and then you do a little bit of a red wine wash, or red wine float on top. It somehow makes you just feel so good afterwards. Maybe it's the protein.
Wow, I'm trying to digest the red wine float. It's kind of like a spodiote with egg.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous drink, and it combines sort of the, I guess, jelliness of the wine with a lemon base to it.
Yeah, it's stunning.
Oh, yum. Since you specialize in really sort of stripped down drinks, 2 and 3 ingredient drinks, think of like an A and a B side you want to share and take us out with something else.
Here we have a classic album paired with one of the great classic easy drinks to make.
So this is a little bit of The Clash, London Calling,
which we pair with a gin and tonic, which is probably the classic British easy drinker.
Love. Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Thanks so much for having us.
I've been talking to siblings Andre and Tanaya Darlington, who grew up flipping their parents' records on a Torrens turntable. Their latest book is called Booze and Vinyl. Coming up, I'm talking to a CEO of a company that's trying to change the way we discover restaurants. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. The Infatuation is a fast-growing restaurant discovery platform. And if you're on Instagram, there's a good chance you've drooled over a photo of theirs. Just recently, The Infatuation announced its acquisition of Zagat. CEO Chris Steng joins me to discuss his company's ambitions. So social media and food. Do you think at the beginning of social media, people imagined how much food would take up the space?
It's so obvious that food is one of the few things we all share. And so, you know, I think we all eat every day, right? And it's something that's easy to share. So it's amazing how it's evolved. And certainly when we, you know, The Infatuation started thinking about social media as a way to market what we were doing, you know, we had a website and we had an app and we were reviewing restaurants. And, you know, even when Twitter came along, it was very obvious that people were looking to connect with each other around that shared experience of dining and going to restaurants and sharing food.
I almost feel like it's a diary for lazy people.
Sure. I'm one of those.
Yeah, me too. I can flip through Instagram, go back and look at an image and go, oh, yeah, that's what I was doing that week.
Yeah. And I think more and more as time goes on, people are figuring out how to use the various platforms to help them find things and help them remember things. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Instagram rolled out the save functionality where you can save a photo. And I do that a lot where I'll just sort of curate categorical sections in my saved feed where I can remember restaurants in London or Los Angeles or wherever it might be. And I have I run a company that does this and I'm still using that as a way to keep track.
So talk about the idea of location.
Sure, yeah. When we started, you know, we actually launched The Infatuation in 2009 when my business partner Andrew and I had full-time jobs in the music industry. And what we were doing was really just trying to create a resource for ourselves and for our friends that started with a few key things like, where am I going to be? Who am I going to be with? And what are the sort of vibe or ambiance that I'm looking for, and then backing into what's the best restaurant that fits all of those parameters. You know, location is obviously the most important part of that. In a place like Los Angeles, you know, we all hear about and read about great restaurants on one side of town, but how often are you going to end up over there just to go try a restaurant? So it's often more about what's around me right now that fits my needs in terms of who I'm going to be with and so on and so forth. Since 2009, obviously, we all have increasingly more advanced smartphones in our pockets that know everything about us, including where we are. But that can be a great thing in terms of using these tools to help sort through, you know, all of the options that we all have at our disposal in terms of restaurants. So, you know, we wanted to start with those things, location certainly being one of them, but also situation, meaning, you know, what are you going out to dinner for, whether it's a date, whether it's, you know, sometimes there's a big difference often in a first date versus a date with your significant other or spouse. That's always been the way we sort of differentiated ourselves, was to start with those parameters and then find the best restaurants that fit into them, rather than just saying, here's an amazing chef that's opening an amazing restaurant and here's why you should go there.
when I think about sort of the landscape of refers to we eaters about where to go, there's Zagat, which in its own time was kind of like an analog Yelp, right?
It was like the prequel.
Yeah.
It was really the first, you know, Zagat was really the first example of user-generated content in the space. 1979, Tim and Nina.
I remember.
Yeah, they had their friends filling out paper surveys about all of their favorite restaurants, and they were compiling those surveys into, you know, sort of a conglomerate review, which had those sort of bolded sentences from various people's quotes. You know, Yelp is also user-generated, but by nature, it's a bit different. It's not necessarily just specifically about restaurants. That's probably the, you know, majority of what people use it for, but it's also for dry cleaners and for spas, you know, all kinds of
dentists.
Things. Dentists, sure, which is great. It's all fine. But we've always found, and I think this is probably true for many passionate diners, you know, using that platform can be frustrating because you don't really know who the people are that are writing these reviews. And sometimes it feels like they're there just to air grievances, and that can be frustrating. So what we want to do and why we got really excited about the acquisition of Zagat is we really want to see if we can make a better version of a user-generated platform, which is the DNA of Zagat. And so can we use new technology? Can we use our sense of community? And also thinking about brand, and that Zagat brand is so powerful. So we really want to try and use all of those things to create something new and ideally better and more useful than the other user-generated platforms out there.
Is Zagat still reliant on physical guides, or has it, for the most part, moved onto an online platform?
It's digital. It's online. There's apps and a website, and that's amazing. This was the first year, 2018, at least as far as I understand, that they did not print the guides. And that is something we want to make sure we're doing again. So I think that certainly all of our businesses, whether it's the radio or restaurant reviews or whatever it might be, we all need to figure out ways to innovate and be smart and digital and shareable and all of those things. But there's something really nice still about a printed guide. And we're really excited to start doing that. And a lot of the way we think about it, you know, I came from the music business, and I watched the music industry go from physical formats to digital formats. But at the same time, you know, vinyl is thriving more than it has probably since its heyday in the 70s, right? So there is an appetite for physical formats, and that's something that is very much a part of the Zagat brand, and we want to bring that back.
I find that the experience of browsing in real life is so different than the act of browsing digitally. How you come upon things in a serendipitous manner is totally different.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're just, you know, when you're reading something physical, it's a different thing entirely. When we talk to people about Zagat, people always love to tell us stories about how they would make little notes in the margins and highlight things. And there's something so tactile and amazing about that, that it's important. You know, even though we're all constantly on our phones and, you know, switching between apps, there's something amazing about just sitting down with a printed guide. And maybe I sound, you know, totally romantic about it, but I think it's important.
Are the Zagat stickers that go on the windows of restaurants still going to be a thing?
Yeah, I hope so. We're sort of in this phase of transition and evaluation right now. We just closed the deal a few weeks ago, so we have a lot to do before we start to think about continuing, improving, changing any of those things. So what we're actually trying to do right now, and really we encourage people to reach out to us, is we just want to talk to people that have a passion for the brand, and whether that's people in the restaurant community or people that are just, you know, familiar with, that have been reading Zagat for a very long time. What we want to do is hear from people about the things they love, the things they think that are important. I think we have our own opinions on it because we've all been, you know, readers and users of Zagat for a long time ourselves. But yeah, we're trying not to make any rash decisions right now, and just trying to get started and do right by the brand.
So do you have the ability to look into a crystal ball and see what you think the next food trend is going to be?
Crystal ball or otherwise, I think we actually just did something in New York that we're really excited about. I personally have discovered a passion for wine fairly recently, probably within the last 5 or 7 years, and it's really become something I'm very interested in, at least in terms of drinking. But we've seen through our various, you know, interactions with our community and our peers that there really does seem to be a real interest in wine. And I think you see it in various capacities. The natural wine movement is certainly something that's very real, and people are very excited about this idea of natural wines. And I think there's a, you know, we could probably have a whole other discussion about what that means. But, you know, there are people that ask us all the time about great natural, quote unquote, natural wine bars.
That's Chris Stang, CEO of food media brand The Infatuation. Infatuation's Eats Con Food Festival will return to Barker Hangar in Santa Monica on Saturday, May 19th. Visit eatscon.com for tickets and info. That's 5 E's. Now we turn to a couple of LA natives who are also no strangers to hawking food on social media. And did you do a thing where people had to, like, message you to get the address?
Yes. So we put our detailed instructions in the caption. You know, if you want to order, you have to call in between this time or send a text. You get the address. You don't get the address until you call. We're screening people, making sure, you know, everything's legit.
That's Malachi Jenkins and Roberto Smith. In 2013, they began using Instagram to sell soul food classics out of a Compton apartment. Today, the business is booming with pop-up events across the country, celebrity catering gigs, and a food truck in Portland. Somewhere, they found the time to publish their first cookbook called Trap Kitchen, Bangin' Recipes from Compton. I hear you just opened a truck up in, or a cart up in Portland.
Yes, we did.
But you have roots that go back to Portland, don't you?
Yes, that's where I originally started cooking, doing private chef work out of culinary school.
Which you went to in Las Vegas, right?
Yes, Cordon Bleu, Las Vegas.
So tell me how you started cooking.
Basically, I wanted to eat holiday food all year round, you know?
That's a really good reason, yeah. I'd say. So your mom let you in?
Yeah, mom, grandma. Well, mom worked two jobs, so she didn't really have a choice because when we were at home after school, we had to eat. So, you know, I got in there.
So about how old were you by the time you were, like, pushing her aside and saying, no, I got this?
Like 11, 12.
Yeah, that's like me.
Boy Scouts, and we went to camp, like, you know, summer camp, where you get to help out in the kitchen. That was always my duty. I always volunteered to work in the kitchen.
What did you like better, the idea of feeding people and making them happy or actually touching the food and getting to eat yourself?
Feeding people and making them happy. It was the reaction from people when they taste your food and they just go crazy about it, you know. That's the most rewarding thing right there.
So how did the two of you find one another? You famously come from these feuding gangs.
Well, we have two mutual friends. Well, they're cousins, and they brought us together, and then we branched off, did our own thing.
Yeah.
So were you also a secret cook, or you Mr. Communications?
No, I mean, I wasn't a secret cook. I took a liking in cooking just to entertain female friends when they came to my house.
Very smart, man.
That's what made me start wanting to cook.
A lot of good nights, man.
Yeah.
Going in that kitchen.
I imagine that you had a lot of ups and downs, things that happened to youth out there in the world. What finally brought it all together and gave you the idea to try and make a business out of cooking from home?
The streets can be rough sometimes. When you've been in them for so long, it's like, when is you going to figure out a way to get out of them? So we've seen a little light, and we ran with the light.
Yeah, social media.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect marketing platform, and it's free. And I have been documenting all my whole culinary journey from culinary school all the way to going on tours and cooking for various rappers and just being in Portland doing different things. And people will always ask me, like, oh, when can we try your food? When is it going to be available? You need to open a restaurant. Can you cook for me? And bro saw that, and he was like, man, we need to do something with this.
Yeah, I was on there marketing just different products, like retail products. So I knew, like, the power of Instagram. Like, you can, you know what I'm saying, make a lot of money off of it. And it just was slow with the clothes, so we needed a new product. So I seen food.
That's so smart. Do you remember what the very first thing you posted was that you had for sale?
Yeah. Chicken and shrimp enchilada pie, black beans, and Spanish rice for $8. And our grandma had baked a cake, a slice of cake for $1.
Well, lemon cake?
Lemon cake, yeah.
So what happened when all of a sudden cars start driving up? It must have blown your mind in a way.
Yeah, it really was.
In the most humbling way, it was crazy.
I mean, you know, like, before that had happened, it took some hard work to make $200-$300, you know, and this was like a piece of cake, you know what I'm saying? And it was within an hour, 2 hours, we were sold out.
Literally a piece of cake.
Yeah, piece of cake. Grandma's cake.
Grandma's cake.
Did you ever feel like it was a grind, or were you sort of just kind of floating along on how much love you were getting from Instagram?
I think it was a little bit of both. the love kept us going. You know what I'm saying? So we grind, we get up. It might be early mornings. We cooking all day. But at the end of the day, we slapping hands. We laughing about the day. We just talking about all the customers that came through. We just amazed by it.
Yeah. It was really like, okay, we start off with breakfast, right? We went from doing like one meal a day and, you know, we're like, okay, how we can cut our costs down? You know, so we started with breakfast, which is cheap to cook, you know. So, boom, we had the breakfast menu. Then by 12 o'clock, we sold out. We heading back to the store for our dinner session, you know. And then we, like, we're experimenting with what works with people, what doesn't work, what do they like, what do they don't like.
Tell me a little bit about that. Are you making, like, super healthy diet kind of food?
Oh, yeah. We started out doing it with, we had
tilapia,
baked chicken breast, broccoli and yellow rice, you know, something light. And affordable.
But then it seems like you fell into a vat of
soul food,
rich,
yeah. Barbecue. And I mean, you got to give people what they want.
Got to give them what they want, man, or else you ain't going to be out of business.
So tell me, give me a lineup of like the best, the ones that you know, like it's no brainer. The minute you press that button, you're going to be sold out.
We'll start, bro.
Oh, barbecue.
Gumbo, barbecue, it was the third one.
Pineapple bowls?
Pineapple bowls. Gotta be pineapple bowls.
Yeah. Okay, so describe the pineapple bowls. They're really beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a pineapple cut in half, gut it, and we put the guts to the side for garnish later, fill it up with jasmine rice, then you put your protein on there, which could be salmon, chicken, beef short rib, king crab, shrimp, or lobster. You know,
then, or everything.
Or everything, yeah. Then you top it with green onions and sriracha sauce and teriyaki sauce and sesame seeds.
Don't forget the love.
And some love, too. Oh, yeah. And cut up pieces of pineapple, too.
Yeah, that's the love. You need to take me through your mac and cheese recipe. Because I was reading the book, and I love how you, at the beginning, the description of how to cook the pasta is, forget about al dente.
Yeah, don't do it al dente. You want the noodles kind of swell up a little bit. Just so, I don't know, I remember as a kid when my grandma made her mac and cheese, the noodles was always swollen, you know. And it kind of went well with the creaminess of the cheese. It just gives it a texture, a better texture. Al dente is cool if you're trying to serve quick, you know, or hold the pasta to the side and ready to go, you know, so you can make it as you go. But, yeah, we're into the traditional way of making a mac and cheese pie.
Boil them noodles.
Yeah, boil those noodles. Then you add salt, pepper, Cajun seasoning, parsley.
A ton of butter.
Not even a ton of butter. We use a stick of butter. Maybe a stick. That's not a ton. You know what I'm saying? When you're cooking for 20 or 30 people. Or you use olive oil. Make sure it's fully coated and seasoned right before you even add your cheese sauce. So we use mushroom soup, cheddar cheese soup, cheese whiz, condensed milk, sharp cheddar, mild cheddar, Kobe Jack. Then you get that, you mix it up so it's creamy. You don't even have to use eggs. I know a lot of people use eggs with their mac and cheese. So
you don't even need to pour that over pasta. You can drink that out of a bowl.
Oh my God. Yeah, I like it.
Chips.
I like it wet too. I like it wet. My main thing is the topping, you know, the top layer of the cheese and how the corners get crusty.
Oh, yeah. That's the best part.
Yeah, yeah.
But you talk about how that top layer, you don't want to see any holes.
You don't want to see no noodles in there. Mm-hmm. You have to fully cover every nook and cranny. I don't want to see no noodles sticking out. If we run out of cheese, we have to go back to the store and get more cheese because it has to be fully topped.
So tell me, you guys have become such a sensation. I mean, the business really did go viral. Are you still cooking out of your house?
We're doing pop-ups where we take over somebody else's kitchen or we do catering orders.
Are you looking to do a brick and mortar? Is life too good?
Of course. This is home.
We looking, we got some investors. It's just getting in the bed with the right people. You know what I'm saying? When it comes down to our baby trap kitchen.
Yeah.
You don't want to make a wrong decision.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, and doing business with people who don't have the same mindset as you. They only see
money,
you know, and not really into the love of, it's a difference between just owning the business and actually being hands-on into your brand. You know, and we want somebody that's giving off the same as much energy and vibes as we are.
You know, I noticed that your Instagram has morphed to go from just pictures of food to a lot of pretty inspirational posts. You do a lot of posts about business ideas and links to, is it your sister? Is it really your big sister?
Yeah, those are my older sisters. Yeah, they have their own, they have their own business.
Which is about business.
Yeah.
Has she helped you a lot?
A lot. Mm-hmm. A lot. And she went to law school, so, you know, anytime when we're dealing with entertainment and we need anything redlined or, you know, just on the side of, you know, we street savvy, we're business smart, but we don't know the outs and ins. She went to school for that stuff. My mom went to school for that stuff. So anything I don't know, I'm just glad I have an outlet to go find out what I'm doing.
Yeah, you're really lucky.
We have a whole team, though. We have a whole team. We have PR, we have publicists, we have three managers. You know, we're pretty...
You got to make the money pay all this.
Oh, yeah. Got to make...
Well, thank you so much, guys. I admire you so much, what you've built.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Be looking out for our seasonings. We have a whole line of seasonings coming, and we have merch coming as well.
Follow us on Instagram, TrapKitchen_news.
And at The Real Trap Kitchen.
That's Malachi Jenkins and Roberto Smith of Trap Kitchen, a series of extremely popular pop-up restaurants nationwide. Their first cookbook with Marissa Mendez is Trap Kitchen, banging recipes from Compton. After the break, we're talking all about a dessert that's near and dear to my heart. Pie. That's when good food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
And you want to see that they took their time and that they enjoyed the process, not that they were stressed out to make the perfect-looking pie. They should be really proud of their pie.
Good Food's Pie Contest is coming up on May 6th, and this year we're featuring our first-ever kids' competition. Joining me with a few tips on baking with children is my friend Clemence Gossett, co-founder of the Gourmandise School of Sweets and Savories in Santa Monica. This year we have this new contest that is sort of on the side of the regular contest, and it's for kids 10 and under, which is a pretty big range.
It's huge.
And the thing I don't want to see are a lot of perfect pies that I know the parents have made for the children.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see the difference between the 4-year-old's pies and the 10-year-old's pies.
Yeah, because there will be quite a big difference. Now, you are a mother of 3 children.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest is how old?
The youngest is 6, the oldest is 19, and the middle one's 15.
So let's talk about Zavi, the youngest, who is baking quite a bit lately.
Yeah, he likes the tactile stuff. For him, it's like Play-Doh. So Zavi likes to shape bread. But I think some 6-year-olds who are just doing it because they want to get their hands busy overwork pie dough a lot. So he's not the best pie baker.
So this is what I would like you to give us some strategies for 2 different groups. Let's start with the younger ones first. I'm thinking that maybe the best kind of crust for a really young child is a cookie crust.
Totally agree. And you can make a homemade cookie and then add butter to it. So you don't just have to use store-bought stuff, which, you know, we don't recommend anyway. But any kind of dry cookie, like a wafer cookie or a graham cracker, you can bake off. And you want to bake it till it's really nice and crisp. And then you put it in the food processor or you have them melt butter and just kind of mash it all together. You want to get it as fine as possible. And then you press that into the pie tin.
So the weird thing about pie is it's like 3 separate recipes, right? There's the crust or whatever you're using. Then there's the filling. Mm-hmm. And there's whatever you're throwing on top. So for the youngest, what kind of filling would you recommend?
Pudding. So you would want them to do a stovetop custard, not a custard that would make them have to like pour it in and then put it in the oven. We certainly don't want kids to put hot things in the oven. So giving them a press-in pie filling and then a filling like a cooked pudding, like chocolate pudding or a pastry cream that they can then dress with whipped cream or chocolate shavings or anything like that would probably be the best.
How do you navigate while baking with a child, allowing their expression to come through and holding back on your own desire to make things look more perfect?
Well, every kid is different. So I have three kids, and I bake with them very differently each. And I do it the same way that I teach classes, where I demonstrate first how I would do it, and then I let them just do whatever they want. Because trying to get them to conform to what you want will never work. It will not be fun. And in the end, you shouldn't really care about what the end result is, because it's really about the process and the flavor. And they'll feel much more comfortable trying to improve their skills if you just leave them alone.
Now let's talk about older children. In this city, there are 10-year-olds who I know are just entering the adult contest because they have a skill level and a comfort with food that's kind of really odd.
Yeah. We have some precocious bakers out there.
Yes. Excellent way to describe it. Talk to me about some crust and filling choices that could work for them. For a child, is the best thing to just do a food processor?
No, I really, really strongly believe in the hand method of making pie crust and in just the flaking between the thumb and the index and middle finger. And just getting the kids to do that, because you want it to be an intuitive process. So if you're using the food processor and you don't understand that if you overwork the food processor, overworks the dough, you just don't see what's happening in there. So get a big bowl and you put in 3 cups of all-purpose flour and 1 cup of whole wheat flour, and you put in 1 pound of butter and have them flake it so that they're little flakes about the size of their thumbnail. And then they only add enough ice water, shoveling it in till it comes together in this really shaggy mass. Then you split it in two, you put it in the refrigerator, wrap it up, flatten it out a little bit, and then they should make their filling.
So you advise making a filling where the starch and the sugar and the fruit doesn't cook within the crust. You prefer to do it outside the crust because, once again, you can see what's happening. So stovetop.
Yes. Stovetop. I like to do the stovetop method because every fruit is different, and it's hard to see in the end, if you added enough starch or anything. I also like doing things days ahead of time. So if I can pre-cook my pie filling and store it in the refrigerator, then it's cooled off, because you should never put a warm filling in a pie crust.
So is there a template for making that kind of fruit filling?
So I take about 6 cups of fruit, blueberries or blackberries or cherries, and I cook them down with a little bit of lemon juice and sugar, and then whatever else I want to add, vanilla or whatever.
So just enough sugar till it tastes good?
Yes. I don't use very much sugar in my pie filling. You add as much sugar as you like. It's your pie. So keep tasting it. And once all the fruit starts to bubble up, then you can add your starch. So you can take water and flour, or water and cornstarch, mix them together to make
slurry.
Slurry, yeah. It should look like whole milk kind of thing. And then you're going to pour in just enough, start with half, pour in a little bit and stir, stir, stir with your fruit. And if it thickens up right away, you don't need to add more.
So then we refrigerate that.
Well, the quickest thing to do is just to grab a clean cookie sheet and pour the filling onto the rimmed cookie sheet. And it'll only take 20 minutes to cool, because it's a nice wide surface area. So if you're in a hurry, that's what you want to do.
And then when you go to put it in your lined pie plate and then put a lid on it, whether it's crumble or it's another rolled out pie crust, you don't need to worry about cooking it that long, because now all you're doing is cooking the dough.
Because the fruit's already cooked. So I still wait till the fruit bubbles up. And if you're worried about sort of the minutiae of all the detail, just have your kids take a pair of scissors and just snip the crust right at the edge of the lip of the pie tin. That way we can see, as judges, all the flakiness in the crust. And there isn't sort of this overworking by trying to pinch things perfectly and crimp perfectly. Just don't use the fork, because that pushes down all the flakiness.
No, the fork is the ugliest, in my opinion.
I
don't get it either.
Story.
No, I mean, Sherry Yard, noted pastry chef, is a big advocate of the scissors.
Yes.
So what you're doing is you're actually cutting both the top and bottom crust together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looks beautiful. You mentioned that at Gourmandise, you occasionally hold cooking classes for kids. What kind of skills do you prioritize building in the early years?
When we teach kids and we start at age 6, we start with 10 minutes of kitchen safety, and then we teach them everything the adults do. So if they're learning how to make sushi or fresh pasta, the menu is exactly the same as the adults. So we just demonstrate the technique and we explain to them the science, and they're far less afraid than the adults. I think the kids come away with more confidence than grown-ups do, we just arm them with really simple tools. We don't gadgetize things. And we just have them work the doughs and explain that they have to rest. And then they're a lot less scared. It's really fascinating.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Are you going to be part of the judging panel this year?
I am. I don't know which category I'm judging this year, but I'm hoping it's not savory pies. No more lobster or crawfish pie, please.
In the hot sun.
Uh-huh.
That's Clemence Gossett of the Gourmandise School of Sweets and Savories here in Santa Monica. She's been sharing some tips on baking with your children. Don't forget, kids 10 and under are invited to register for Good Foods Pie Contest on May 6th. Young bakers can choose from 8 pie types and will be judged separately from the rest of the event. The last day to register is April 29th, so please do not delay. Register at kcrw.com/pie. Now for a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where California's state vegetable is in season.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm so happy to be visiting right now with Patrick Healy, who is executive chef and partner at the Buffalo Club on Olympic Boulevard. That's the one that always looks like it's closed or secret or private. But Patrick, you're here to tell us that the Buffalo Club is open for business.
It's open to the public. Thanks for having me, Laura.
So tell us what you're shopping for today.
Today I'm shopping for artichokes. We do a dish at the restaurant with a Mediterranean lutamere, which translates as the wolf of the sea. It's one of the finer fishes that you can find in Europe. And we pair it with baby artichokes.
Okay, so roasted all together, how do you do that?
It's actually a traditional preparation from the south of France, from Provence. It's called a la barigoule. Mm-hmm. And what that means is it's served with braised artichokes that are braised in a little bit of stock with onions and carrots and a little bit of mushrooms. So we garnish the dish with the artichokes, and then I also make a sauce that's based on a puree of baby artichokes that's emulsified with olive oil.
Mm. Okay, so the artichokes are prepared in one dish, and then the lutamere goes in the oven in another dish.
And then it sits on a bed of Bloomsdale spinach and ramps. So it's really, it's a spring dish.
And what is it about the baby artichoke that's better than the big artichoke for this dish?
Well, in my experience, baby artichokes have a stronger, nuttier flavor than the larger artichokes. You can also eat the whole thing. I mean, you have to peel back a few of the outside leaves, which are tough, but I think people are a little intimidated about how to trim them, and it's really not that complicated. The first time I learned to prepare baby artichokes was in France with Julia Child. She was a close family friend, and I actually spent a lot of time. I lived in France for 5 years, and about a year after I arrived, I was invited to cook with her and Simone Beck at her house just outside Cannes in this tiny village where I was actually working in a small butcher shop. And when I came in, there was this huge basket of baby artichokes, and I had never had the opportunity to prepare them. I didn't know what to do. And she just guided me through it, you know, with her high, screechy voice.
I know. And then when I peel artichokes, I always feel like I'm peeling too much. And then the other question, how much of the stem are you leaving on?
The stem is completely edible, but what you have to do is peel it with a vegetable peeler. Essentially, for large artichokes and baby artichokes, you want to peel the green part away so the white is exposed. And also you want to make sure you use lemon. At some point they should soak in lemon after the trimming process, which keeps them from turning brown. A big mistake that a lot of people make is that they'll cook the artichoke in lemon juice, and then it masks the flavor of the artichoke. So you really just want to soak the artichoke for about 20 minutes, remove it from the lemon water, and then cook it however you're doing, whether it's roasting, sautéing. Mm. My favorite way to do them is to poach them first, mm-hmm. then cut them in half and sauté them in a little bit of olive oil until they get very crisp. Mm. And they're just wonderful like that.
And why Buffalo Club? Where'd that name come from?
My partner, Tony Yurkovich, is from Buffalo, New York. There you go.
Okay, and why does it look so private?
We were one of the first sort of retro speakeasy type restaurants. So we didn't have any signage outside, and it was very mysterious. And then Once you walk through the doors, of course, it's absolutely beautiful. Now, we've been open 23 years now. Yeah, it's been quite a thrilling ride.
That was Patrick Healy. He's executive chef and partner at the Buffalo Club on 15th and Olympic, and inviting you in to the restaurant and then out into the courtyard to experience the food. I'm talking now with one of the farmers who grows artichokes. In fact, as I walked around today, I realized we have several farmers now that are bringing in artichokes. This is Chris Edwards. He's from Ruta's Farm in Arroyo Grande. And you've got a nice, sort of, I call it a medium-sized artichoke on your table. I've seen these giant $5 artichokes. So yours is kind of a nice, you know, size. Tell us the program for how do you grow artichokes?
Well, what we do is a lot of people allow their artichokes to grow perennially. So what we actually do is we replant every year. It's just a little easier for us for our crop rotation. So essentially, we drop the seeds off at our local nursery, and they essentially get the starts going for us. And after probably about a couple months or so there, we get the transplants, and we plant them in our soil and then allow those to mature. And it's usually about, in total, about 150 to 180 days, roughly. Definitely takes a little while.
That's Six months.
Yeah, that's why you always see artichokes at a higher dollar. You know, it's a lot of weeding, a lot of water, a lot of fertilizer. And so, yeah, once they mature, we go through and we start cutting them down. And that's when we get these, like, you know, nice big medium to larger size. You know, our climate isn't quite as warm, so they're not going to be as, like, substantial. And we don't dump a boatload of fertilizer on it. So that's just, you know, another thing. When you use organic fertilizer, you're not going to get like the same nitrogen levels to really boost them up as well. But yeah, once we cut the larger ones, we'll go back through on subsequent cuttings and essentially get the smaller artichokes. And so depending on what you're looking for, you know, we kind of have it all each, you know, following week.
And the artichoke plants, I've seen them, they're really big. So you must plant them, what, 3 or 4 feet apart?
Yeah, roughly around 3 to 4 feet.
Okay, so they take up a lot of space, they take a long time, mm-hmm. and that's kind of why they're a little bit costly.
Absolutely. And they're absolutely delicious.
And they're so delicious. And how long are you going to have them?
Well, this year we planted a substantial amount. Usually we only do one crop, but I think we have 3 fields this year. So we should have them through the majority of the summer.
Do you think they taste better earlier in the season as opposed to later in the season?
You know, I am not good at those questions. I think they taste great year-round. Well, not year-round, but, you know, throughout the season. I really have a hard time differentiating between an early and a later season for most vegetables, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, there's certain things, depending on the climate and, like, how cool or how hot it is, you can tell the difference. But these always seem to hold true to their flavor.
And how do you like to eat them?
Oh, man. Well, recently I have just been parboiling them, cutting them in half, loading them with butter and garlic, and throwing them on the grill or broiling them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's your dip?
My dip. Oh, man. The dip. Well, the other day, what did I make? It was a new recipe, and I think it was something along the lines of, it was like a mustard and cream base with some garlic and some smoked paprika and a little cayenne, you know, just something simple, just threw a few ingredients in. And yeah, I don't really have like a specific preference, but I'll dip it in anything that's close by.
All right, that was Chris Edwards. He works here with Ruta's Farm. They come down from Arroyo Grande every week at the Wednesday market, and artichokes are in season, so come on by. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Many of us have been waiting for Jonathan Gold's thoughts on David Chang's new restaurant, Major Domo. Stick around for his review. It's after this break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
The idea of this restaurant is everything is just a little bit too much, and I'm okay with that.
Finally, here's Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold. He's here with a review that we've been anticipating for quite some time. Hello, Mr. Gold.
Hello, Ms. Kleinman.
Where are we going?
We're going to somewhere next to Chinatown.
Yeah, a northern district of downtown LA that I had never been in before.
I don't think I'd ever been on it either. I mean, if somebody said the words Nod Street to me, they would mean absolutely nothing. And suddenly, because of Major Domo, David Chang's new restaurant, it's, I suppose, one of the hot streets downtown.
We should say that Major Domo has been, like, the biggest opening of the year.
I think that would be safe to say.
And a restaurant that noted restaurateur David Chang from New York and worldwide domination has come to L.A. to open this restaurant.
Right. He has an extraordinarily good restaurant in Sydney. He has a restaurant in Toronto I haven't been to. He has a sort of middling place in D.C., and he has some decent places in New York City.
And we should also say, I guess, at some point in this review that he is the main figure producing and behind Ugly Delicious, in which both of us appear.
Right. We make knishes together.
Yes. And then you're in another couple of episodes.
I'm in the taco episode.
The taco episode.
We go through East LA together.
Yeah. So tell me about the food.
There will be a lot of small dishes. There will be a lot of, especially in Los Angeles, vegetable-y things. He seems to have completely fallen in love with the local farmers market produce. There will be sort of giant blingy things for the table that cost sort of a large amount of money. Not when you look at the quality of ingredients or the amount of time that's going into it, but certainly—
It's a commitment.
It's a commitment.
So let's talk about some of the starters. Did you have the chilies filled with the Benton sausage?
I did. I'm a fan of the Benton Smokehouse. Their ham and their country sausage is great. It's a smokehouse in Tennessee. The sausage I'm possibly less in love with, but you thought differently, obviously, because you brought
it up. I liked it, but I was thinking somebody should introduce David to Chori Man.
One of the most interesting of appetizers is jjimukbap. Which is, usually when you see that in Korean, it means like a big old rice ball. Here, they serve it as rice with seasonings on it and with things in it. And you're given a couple of plastic gloves and you're supposed to mold it yourself. And the tactile sensation is interesting. It's a fun dish. It's not particularly serious.
It's kind of like umami bomb rice.
Right.
What about the bings?
Bings is a general term that means Chinese pancakes. There are versions in like Taiwan and some parts of China where they're super flat and they're griddled and they lay an egg and cook it onto that and then wrap it around some pork floss or something. He serves it almost as blini, I guess, but he serves them with different things. There's a plainish version with butter and honey that's actually really nice. That would be my favorite. It's very morning pancakey. I mean, he does a dish with, he calls them Malibu cherry tomatoes, which I assume means they were grown in Malibu. Even in the early spring, they were beautifully sweet and ripe. There was a little bit of shiso, and then it was served on tofu. So it was very much like an izakaya dish, except it had super right-on tomatoes. And it was a really nice vegetable dish. He does something that's unlike anything I've ever had before with raw sugar snap peas that he tosses with horseradish, a little lemon, maybe some mint shallots. I would say that that's probably my favorite thing. And there's a kind of crudité plate that he calls the Bounty Bowl, which is, I guess, a bunch of leaves of things and some peas and some other vegetables and two bowls. One, he calls it domojang, which is fermented bean sauce, I guess, pretty close to, you know, the doenjang that you'd see in a Korean restaurant. And then some you know, brightly flavored homemade miso. He's good with the fermentations.
What dishes did you have that were served tableside?
A lot of the dishes have sort of an elaborate tableside thing going on. There's the Santa Barbara rock crab, for example, which is served in a few different ways. You know, one fried rice that's mounded in the shell, and then there's sort of like knuckles that you can pry the meat out of. And like chilled claws. that are presented on this board with all these little bowls, and somebody is always telling you how to eat them. There are carts that go around, including one cart that is there basically to present the pickle that he gives you like a 3-gram bowl of at the beginning of the meal. And then there are the giant meat carts that are definitely convenient. I mean, you know, the chefs will come out and they'll do the do at the table, but they'll also announce to everybody in the restaurant that, look, somebody's having this giant meat dish. I mean, it's not quite the same as like having, you know, the bell rung at Farrell's or whatever. Dissimilar either.
Good meat.
It's good meat, most of it. The ones that I really liked were the, I guess he calls it the whole plate short rib, which is the technical name for the cut of meat. It's sort of Flintstonian. I mean, you have giant bones sticking out. You have a giant piece of meat in there. They cut off the top part and they slice it and they arrange it around a plate. And they're peppery and they've been smoked for a fairly long time at a fairly low temperature. And they have that softness and the succulence. And pretty much what you're trying to get out of a fatty cut of beef like short rib. Then when you're finished with them, and he gives you all kinds of things to wrap them in and season them with and dip them in, they take away what's left and they bring back this sort of gloriously fatty beef fried rice.
Wow.
It's a remarkable dish. And let me say, the short rib is $190 and the lamb is $175. They feed a lot of people, but you're still making a commitment.
What about the skate wing? I never tried that. Did you have it?
Yeah, I thought that was probably the most successful of the specifically Korean-ish dishes. It was basically bibimbap. There was rice that was seasoned. There was gochujang and other Korean pickles and stuff mixed into it. Underneath were these chunks of, or slabs rather, of fried skate wing on the bottom at exactly the place where if you were getting bibimbap, you'd have the burnt parts of rice.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
So glad to be here, Evan.
That's Jonathan Gold on David Chang's new restaurant, Major Domo. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866 and you will get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Very convenient to have. That's it for this week's Good Food. If you missed any part of the show, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also find a podcast of our show on Apple Podcasts. Please do us a favor and leave us a review if you liked what you heard. It helps other people find the show. And just another reminder, enter your pies in KCRW's pie contest. Don't procrastinate. The deadline is April 29th. Registration is at kcrw.com/pie. So once again, I have to thank all the members of the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we'll all be back with another show of Good Food next week.